It's my new obsession. Yeah, pink, it's not even a question. Pink on the lips of your lover. Cause pink is the love you discover.
Welcome to the Marilyn York Show. Warning, this program is not for the faint of heart. Listen at your own peril. If you have questions about marriage, relationships, or divorce, call 823-1920. And now, here's your host, Marilyn York.
Good morning, everyone. This is Marilyn York, and you are listening to my show. And today's guest is the Honorable Judge Robert Perry. Welcome to the studio, Judge. I know he doesn't like to be called judge, but I'm calling him that because I'm on air and I will be held responsible otherwise. He is the district court judge with the Second Judicial District Court and the man who sentenced James Bela yesterday. Again, for those of you who don't know his name without the face, the famous face with the mustache, I'm looking at it and you are not. If you'd like to talk to him, you're welcome to call the studio. 823-1920 is the call-in number. Or as usual, you can get on my Facebook and post questions if that is your preferred way of communicating. 823-1920, one more time, is the number. And in the meantime, we're going to have a little conversation with the Honorable Judge Robert Perry and see what it's like to be a judge across the street. I know all too well the judges in the family court, but I do not know the civil court judges very well because I don't go across the street, with a rare exception. So, Judge Perry, your background in particular interests me, so I'd like to start there. If you could tell the general public, you know, how you got involved in being a lawyer.
Well, it's kind of a long story. I was raised in Topeka, Kansas, by a single mom. My parents never got married, which was a big deal back in the 40s. We moved back from Oregon, where I was born, to Topeka and lived with my grandmother and some other family members. And we're kind of a working class family. My mom cleaned houses. She periodically sold real estate, worked in restaurants. And we lived in a racially mixed neighborhood in a town where segregation was the law. And I was always kind of impressed by that because as a kid, I couldn't see a heck of a lot of difference between me and the other kids that lived in the neighborhood. And yet I understood that the law, in sort of a vague way, that the law supported separating us in all their aspects of our life. And so I had sort of a gut feeling about the nature of how our government worked, and just a sort of a child's feeling about the injustice of that situation. And I think that sort of just went into the back of my mind and sort of permeated there for a number of years. I went through high school. Didn't have completely a bumpless experience in high school.
So you're a little bastard is what you're saying.
Well, not really. I didn't do anything real bad, but I did a couple of things that probably would have gotten a little more attention today. I ended up going into the Marine Corps right out of high school at the prompting of a juvenile court judge, which sounds kind of interesting in the context of the fact that I'm now a judge.
Yeah. Most of us didn't talk to judges at that age.
But I did. What I did do is I found out that I needed some structure in my life, which I didn't have. And I wish we had an ability to provide that structure to the lives of youngsters and teenagers today in different ways than we do. Because the Marine Corps really straightened me out. I mean, I got down to Parris Island, and I think I wished the minute I got there that I'd made another decision. But it just gave me the structure and the discipline to kind of take another view of the world. And I said this is going to be kind of a long story.
Hey, it's a good story.
And during that time period, I made up my mind. I was in the infantry. I made up my mind that although I enjoyed some aspects of that, that was not what I wanted to do forever. And when I finally got out of the service, I had accumulated a few years of college. Wanted to go back and finish my college education, and did that. And I decided that I wanted to go to graduate school, but I wasn't sure which graduate school. And I had studied physics and engineering. I didn't want to go pursue those studies particularly, and I wasn't thinking too much about anything else. And so I thought, well, I'll give law school a try. And because it's flexible. I mean, you can have a law degree, and you can be a business person. You could be a professor. You could work for a corporation. You could run your own law practice. You could do all kinds of different areas of the law. And so I took it for flexibility. I'd gone to school in Kansas, as I said. Went to college for a couple of years in Annapolis, Maryland. So I knew that I didn't want to stay in the tornado capital of the world back in Topeka. And I wasn't particularly excited about the East Coast, so I thought I'd try the West Coast. And so I packed up my Volkswagen, $200, and started driving west from Topeka. And Denver was too big, Salt Lake City was too slow, and I hit Reno, and the combination of Lake Tahoe and the entertainment that was available for a young man who'd just spent about 7 years in the service in 1970 was a great place, and I got a job working for the DA's office as a criminal investigator.
So how did you choose to practice law when you said that you went to law school to keep it flexible? What steered you to actually being a lawyer?
Well, first of all, I got down to $20. I needed a job.
That does influence the decision.
Living in a hotel over on West 4th Street, motel on West 4th Street, which is still there. And I was looking for work. I didn't know anybody in Reno, and I went over to the DA's office, and I talked to Bob Rose, who was the DA at the time, and we hit it off. And I told him what my background had been, that I'd been a construction worker, I'd been a bartender, I'd run a restaurant, I'd delivered newspapers, been in the Marine Corps. I'd done a lot of things that are kind of out of the line of what you expect from somebody, you know, who's a prospect for a job in the DA's office. And I'd worked as a juvenile corrections officer, too, for one summer when I was in law school. And so we got along pretty well. And in those days, you could not take the bar unless you lived here for a year. And so I had to have something to do for a year. And so he hired me as a criminal investigator, which is basically a detective, or sometimes a glorified errand boy for the district attorney's office. But we made arrests and served subpoenas and did investigations, and I got interested in that. And it's the people part of the law that I've always enjoyed. The technical part and the rules of law, they're interesting to me only insofar as they apply to people's lives.
I'm with you there.
And so as we started through doing these criminal cases, they became more and more interesting to me. And I had a case, I couldn't take the bar. I'll tell you a quick story. Took the bar. I couldn't take it for a year. I took the bar. Then after I took it, Bob Rose called me into his office and was very morose and sat me down. And, you know, he said, "I need to tell you something." And then he jumped up and came around and shook my hand and said, "You passed the bar."
It's like a death sentence for some of us. No, I passed.
And so anyway, I was in a trial at that time with Mills Lane, who was the deputy district attorney. And it was a case called State v. Louis St. Pierre, if I remember correctly. And I went up to the courthouse, up to the courtroom, and Judge Bowen swore me in, and Mills said, "You've got the next witness." And I had no idea that was going to happen.
Yeah, no, that's a heck of a way to learn.
Obviously, it wasn't a very important witness. But
I doubt that.
So I got to ask a few questions, and I just started enjoying the process of working with people, working with their problems, trying to solve their problems, trying to understand them, trying to do what was right in the context of their situations. And I already knew from life experience, but I learned more and more that, you know, there's not too many things that are just black and white. You know, there's always something.
It's unjarring to me how much gray there is in the world. Yeah. And when I think I have a position and I believe something, I walk into court and I find myself being convinced sometimes of the other side in my own case, thinking, wow, my client's a jerk.
Yeah.
And then it flips as soon as you put your client back up and they explain. The context to me is so important about why people do things. And even if the law doesn't care why, I always care why. I always want to understand why.
Yeah, no, that's the thing that really impressed me about the law. I mean, it wasn't, I mean, I mean, this is going to sound funny, but I would talk to people and sometimes clients, and I wouldn't hear a much different story than I would hear if I was still tending the bar and they were telling me about a problem that they had.
Yeah, only you can finally manipulate the outcome to some extent.
And you know, but yeah, you're in a position where if it's a problem where they genuinely are entitled to some help and that's what they're asking for, you can give it to them. And, you know, to some extent.
Sure.
And I think that's the thing that attracted me most to the law and particularly to do it to trial law. You know, it's a... I suppose it's no surprise that there are lots of television shows about about lawyers and trials and stuff like that because they really are exciting and interesting events in the lives of human beings and how the interplay of those lives relate to one another. So,
of course, they're better on TV, and they speak so much better than I do. I always wish I could give such beautiful arguments. I need a writer.
Well, you know, some are better on TV and some are not.
Yeah.
And some are realistic on TV and some are not. I know in criminal cases, the prosecutors always say, now, don't hold us to the standards of
CSI.
CSI because, you know, they work miracles there. And
we
in reality,
wish.
They don't, those miracles don't necessarily translate into everyday life in criminal cases. So.
Yeah, we wish. No such technology exists in most instances. Which shows do you think in particular are realistic from your perspective? Even if they're back in the heyday.
I'm not a big TV fan. I like to watch, sometimes I watch Law and Order, but I don't necessarily buy into the reality of those. One of my favorite movies is To Kill a Mockingbird.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that because it takes me back to my own childhood of segregation and it gives me the opportunity to see. And it's one of the things that I thought was so cool about the law, because even in 1954 when they passed Brown versus the Board of Education, when that decision was entered, it took a few years to implement it. But even then, I was impressed with the idea that there was one branch of law that seemed to have the sense to recognize what kids knew.
Yeah,
and that is that, you know, the segregation was not a reasonable way to approach a society of human beings.
We have to take a break and hear a word from our sponsors. When we come back, we'll continue to talk to Judge Perry about his experience and how he got into being today's judge. We'll be right back.
There's a lot going on right here in Nevada. Rather than just hear about it, talk about it. 6 to 10 weekdays, Fox 1270 in the morning.
If you've never visited the Wild Horse Saloon, you need to come out and visit. It's Nevada's most unique saloon with great food, great libations, amazing entertainment 24 hours a day. What kind of entertainment, you ask? Well, the Wild Horse Saloon has brought back live burlesque shows with new shows starting every hour, 24 hours a day, with different entertainers every hour. No show is ever the same twice. So come to the Wild Horse. Throw your legs over the saddle. We have actual Western saddle bar stools. And order a cold beer. The Wild Horse Saloon is the place to go and let your hair down. Just have fun. We have fabulous food with everything from pizzas and wings to hamburgers and steaks. We're a huge lunch spot from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and we serve our full food menu until 10 at night and hors d'oeuvres the rest of the night. I'm Susan Austin and I'm personally inviting you to come out and see us at the Wild Horse Saloon. Take I-80 East to exit 28. It's just 15 minutes from downtown Reno. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit. See you soon.
I'm attorney Marilyn York, and my firm exclusively focuses on men's rights in divorce, child custody, and family law matters. I hate advertising. If I'm being honest, I hate it more than anything. Why should you believe anything I have to say about myself? I'm in the best position to say great things about myself, but you don't know me, and there's no reason for you to trust me. So I'm going to ask you to do one thing. If you need help in family law matters, please ask two people in a town of this size, and you should be able to hear my name. I've been doing this for over 11 years exclusively, and if you can't ask two people you trust about me and hear good things, then I'm not the right attorney for you. On the other hand, I believe you will hear good things about us, and when you do, then we're the law firm for you. At a minimum, you will need legal advice when going through something like this, and you may need representation. Again, this is Marilyn York. Please call us at 324-7979. That's 324-7979. Or visit us on the web at marilynyork.net, not com, marilynyork.net.
There's a piece of Nevada's history just 15 minutes from downtown Reno, the legendary Mustang Ranch Museum, Nevada's first legal bordello. Learn about owner Joe Conforti, where he went sideways with the feds over taxes, and they ended up owning and operating the Mustang Ranch. Take a walk down memory lane with Joe and Sally. See where they lived while they worked. You can see the Rolling Stone magazine cover featuring Joe and his ladies, among other original magazine covers. The Mustang Ranch Museum runs tours from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. for groups large and small, Monday through Saturday. If you have a large group, please book in advance by calling 775-343-1424. Walk-ins are welcome, too. Tours cost $5. Plus, we have a wonderful gift shop with T-shirts, shot glasses, baseball caps, and the largest selection of Native American jewelry. Take I-80 East, exit 28, 15 minutes from downtown. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit, and that's where you'll find us.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's wireless companies, and the National Safety Council.
Fox News Radio, 1270.
Don't you mind fever grinning in your face? Don't mind fever grinning in your face? Yeah, just bear this in mind. A true friend is hard to find. Don't you mind people grinning in your face?
You're back on the Marilyn York Show with the Honorable Judge Robert Perry as my guest today, and we were talking about how he became an attorney, and we're moving our way into how he became our current sitting judge in the Second Judicial District Court. So you worked in the prosecutor's office, the district attorney's office, and then how did that evolve into where you are today?
Well, I was there in the DA's office for a year as a criminal investigator, and then I took the bar, and then I prosecuted criminal cases for about 3 years under Bob Rose, and then Larry Hicks became the DA. Excuse me. About the end of the three-year period, I decided I wanted to take a look at other aspects of the law. I knew that I wanted to do trial work. I knew I wanted to be a trial lawyer. I knew that I just enjoyed to death the dynamics of what occurs in the courtroom, and the way that you develop the truth-finding process by cross-examination, by comparison and evidence, by bringing in other witnesses. It was just very impressive to me how well of a job good lawyers and good judges could do at coming up with what the truth was and ultimately reaching justice in those circumstances. And so I decided to give a shot at civil practice, and I went in with a firm down in Carson City called Laxalt, Berry & Allison. And that was Paul Laxalt, Bob Berry, and Peter Laxalt. And really a good firm. Paul, as everybody knows, I think went on to become governor, United States Senator. Just a very bright man. Everybody in that firm was very intellectually and ethically right on the top of the cusp, and it was a good place to go to learn. And Mr. Berry had some interests in some property at the lake, and he began to develop those interests, and he was doing most of the trial work. So all of a sudden, this new guy, me, comes in there with a fair amount of experience trying criminal cases. But there's a world of difference between civil cases and criminal cases in terms of their complexity and the issues and the
longevity. Cases take forever.
The longevity and the energy that the people put into them. And often in civil cases, both sides are very well motivated, sometimes too motivated, sometimes too well financed, and so they tend to go on and on and on. But the issues are really interesting. I mean, I think I had every kind of civil case from accounting issues, gaming. I did a 7-week-long will contest in Douglas County, employment discrimination cases. I did medical malpractice. I did, and on both sides of the fence. I did a little bit of defense. I represented ordinary people in different kinds of consumer cases. And I think over time, my biggest interest and the thing that I got the most satisfaction, I started to say a kick out of, but satisfaction too, was representing ordinary folks against big business. And I'm not talking about local businesses. I'm talking about Joe Blow against New York Life Insurance Company,
David
for example.
David and Goliath.
Because so many times those folks, really may have had a claim, but it was lost in the multitude of pages of paperwork, and it took a long time to figure out exactly what had happened. And once you figured it out and were able to help them, it was a real treat. And so
it's got to feel like that for you too, though. I always feel like the single law firm gets buried too against the big corporate firm. Of course, they shuffle it around the departments and they get lost. Whereas one individual lawyer sometimes can do a lot more, but it's so expensive.
Well, it requires a lot of focus, and I fully confess to being a workaholic. I mean, I get started on something, and it's hard for me to stop, and that's been to my detriment and to my and
your
to
client's
my benefit.
Benefit and your detriment.
Sometimes, yeah. So I've had a lot of interesting cases, and so I stayed with that firm for about 4 or 5 years. And then I went off and formed my own firm, and pretty much devoted it to consumer type litigation. Like I said, I represented a couple of casinos. I represented a few business people.
Do you prefer jury trials?
Yes.
Why?
Because I think in general. I mean, I should. That's a too quick of an answer. There's a kind of case where you want a judge to decide it because the issues are so substantially legal issues that it would be difficult to get together, 8 to 12 jurors that are going to have the kind of understanding of a real estate transaction from start to scratch that a judge that's been doing it for 30 years would have.
You can shortcut the trial.
So if you have a judge that who you trust in terms of their integrity and their ability, which in my view is the great majority of judges, maybe you would try that case too. But most cases that I like to try them to people, because that's what I think makes our system a beautiful system, is that we don't have bureaucrats and people that are appointed by politicians or dictators or what have you to decide legal issues. We have judges that are elected, and then we also have people who are random members of society who look at these cases from their perspective. And that's what I think the founding fathers of this country wanted. They had all these aristocrats from England making all these legal decisions. All of a sudden, there were ranchers and farmers and people who were coppersmiths and people that were working in Boston that had ordinary jobs that were saying, hey, wait a minute, we have our view of this too. And I think that's a horrendously valuable tool to keep our law in tune with what society wants in a democracy. I just think it's great. I love juries.
Do you think juries should be allowed to decide family law cases? I know they aren't. I know very well that they aren't, but I sometimes wonder what it would do.
Well, I'm not a family law judge.
Because you're lucky.
And you're smart. And I wouldn't undertake to do family law, I don't think, because of the high level of feeling and emotion that is generated by those cases. It's hard to find a person that's not touched by some family law issue that has an opinion that would be very difficult to change. And of course, when we're picking a jury in a civil case, one of the things that I ask a jury, have you or any members of your family been the victim of an armed robbery or a medical malpractice or blah blah blah? And if they say yes, then we have a tendency to say, well, maybe this isn't the right jury for you. Maybe you'd be better on a construction case.
Of course, you could never find a jury that hadn't been divorced or the
product of
a divorced family. But I think that's good.
Point.
I think it's good. I mean, sometimes they're tainted one way or the other. But if you get enough members, I think the personal experience makes them smart and understand the impact. And sometimes I worry that some of our family court judges haven't been touched by a divorce personally and don't understand what it's like to exchange your child at Christmas at noon, you know, or those sort of things, much worse scenarios, of course.
Well, I agree with the idea that I think the more a judge has gotten their feet, hands and feet dirty in the work of life, you know, and doing different kinds of things and experiencing the same kind of things that the people in front of them have experienced, I think that that gives them a valuable perspective that they're never going to learn in a book.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, or even from the bench. Or from, you know, the lawyer box.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. That's part of why your background's so interesting, I think, for the public to be aware of, because of the diversity of it and the, you know, hard knocks way that you came up, because there's no silver spoon story here like so many of the judges have. And I think it makes a big difference. On that note, there's been some talk when you run for election about whether or not you are soft on crime, in part probably because of a misperception of your background. What do you have to say about that? You know, do you think you're soft on crime?
Well,
I mean, you just sentenced Bela, so the timing is great for this conversation. But besides that case,
I think we're going back to some rhetoric that was thrown out there during my last election, and people always look for a little mantra, you know, that they can repeat. I mean, my background itself. I mean, I for example, there's an old story about how Dick Kirkland, before he was the chief of police and before he was the sheriff, and I were making a stop on a drug arrest, and I ended up pulling the gun, firing it, jumping in the back of a truck, and arresting two escaped convicts from San Quentin. And Dick Kirkland wrote an article about that, a story about that, and he also commented in the story that In the 30-some years after I left the DA's office, I never undertook to defend a single criminal defendant. And I've never had an attitude of being soft on crime. I think that mantra came because it was a convenient thing to say during the election. And out of thousands of cases, I think they picked out 14 cases where they thought my sentence was not consistent with what they wanted. The Reno News and Review analyzed those cases and said, I don't have the quote in front of me, but said that they basically were wrong about their analysis, and that some of the decisions that I made weren't even made by me. One was made by another judge. Basically, that the analysis was, you know, a handful out of thousands.
I remember watching your debate during your election, and you specifically addressed some of those cases, and I thought it was really enlightening about the circumstances in those cases and why, you know, the rulings were what they were.
Well, one of them I was blamed for putting a girl on probation, where both the district attorney and the Department of Parole and Probation recommended the probation, and she was defending herself against being forced physically, not emotionally, but not emotionally or psychologically, but physically drugged down the hall by her hair to be a prostitute to pay for this guy's methamphetamine habit, and she stabbed him. And everybody else recommended probation, and I went with it. And nothing real bad ever occurred as a result of that. I don't necessarily want to get into those in those type of details, but the thing is that as a judge, what I try to do, and if I have a leaning, it's towards law enforcement. And so maybe I lean a little the other way because I don't want to be perceived to be too law enforcement, pro-law enforcement, because that's my background. But I try to treat every litigant in the courtroom with the same level of respect that I do every other litigant. And I don't think that the public defender's office is entitled to any more consideration or courtesy, nor do I think the DA's office is entitled to any more courtesy or respect than I give everybody else. And I try to give everybody else as much as I possibly can. And I think that I think there's a feeling, at least by one of those offices, that they're entitled to be treated better than and more differently than the other. And I don't do that, and I think that offended some people, and I think that that probably had something to do with the soft-on-crime rhetoric. Because I don't always do what the DA's office wants me to do. I do what I think is right.
Good. We have a break coming up, and we're going to hear from our sponsors. When we come back, we'll continue to talk to Judge Perry, and we have a call waiting. If you'll sit tight, we will get right to you as soon as the break is up. Thanks.
Up late? Phil Hendry will keep you laughing overnight, 1 to 4 a.m. on Fox News Radio 1270.
If you've never visited the Wild Horse Saloon, you need to come out and visit. It's Nevada's most unique saloon with great food, great libations, amazing entertainment 24 hours a day. What kind of entertainment, you ask? Well, the Wild Horse Saloon has brought back live burlesque shows, with new shows starting every hour, 24 hours a day, with different entertainers every hour. No show is ever the same twice. So come to the Wild Horse. Throw your legs over the saddle. We have actual Western saddle bar stools. And order a cold beer. The Wild Horse Saloon is the place to go and let your hair down. Just have fun. We have fabulous food with everything from pizzas and wings to hamburgers and steaks. We're a huge lunch spot from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and we serve our full food menu until 10 at night and hors d'oeuvres the rest of the night. I'm Susan Austin, and I'm personally inviting you to come out and see us at the Wild Horse Saloon. Take I-80 East to exit 28. It's just 15 minutes from downtown Reno. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit. See you soon.
I'm attorney Marilyn York, and my firm exclusively focuses on men's rights in divorce, child custody, and family law matters. Are you tired of being ignored and mistreated? Don't let your divorce lawyer treat you like your wife did. I thought divorce was about breaking free from the ball and chain. At our office, you get competence with personality and hopefully some laughs to take the edge off. Divorce is hard enough. Don't let your lawyer be part of the pain. Let's be honest. Legal representation is expensive, but often necessary. As the saying goes, everyone hates lawyers until they need one. You can get punished for free by calling your ex. Don't pay your attorney for punishment when you're finally getting rid of her. At a minimum, you need legal advice when you're going through something like this. And you may need representation. If you do, call me, Marilyn York, at 324-7979. That's 324-7979. Or visit our website at marilynyork.net. Not calm.
There's a piece of Nevada's history just 15 minutes from downtown Reno, the legendary Mustang Ranch Museum, Nevada's first legal bordello. Learn about owner Joe Conforti, where he went sideways with the feds over taxes, and they ended up owning and operating the Mustang Ranch. Take a walk down memory lane with Joe and Sally. See where they lived while they worked. You can see the Rolling Stone magazine cover featuring Joe and his ladies, among other original magazine covers. The Mustang Ranch Museum runs tours from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. for groups large and small, Monday through Saturday. If you have a large group, please book in advance by calling 775-343-1424. Walk-ins are welcome, too. Tours cost $5. Plus, we have a wonderful gift shop with T-shirts, shot glasses, baseball caps, and the largest selection of Native American jewelry. Take I-80 East, exit 28, 15 minutes from downtown. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit, and that's where you'll find us.
You want to quit smoking? Well, you can do it in just a few steps. All you need is a little motivation.
Get ready.
First, set a date to quit.
Get medicine.
Talk to your doctor about medicines that can help you.
Get help.
Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW, a free service that can help you get started. Or go to ahrq.gov/consumer for more information about quitting.
You can quit smoking.
A few easy steps that'll help save your life. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Fox 1270.
Judge said, son, what is your alibi? If you were somewhere else, then you won't have to die. Well, I said not a word, though it meant my life. For I've been in the arms of my best friend's wife.
You're back on the Marilyn York Show with the Honorable Judge Robert Perry as my guest today. And we have a call from a very patient woman, Tanya. What is your question or comment for the judge, Tanya?
I'd like to ask him his opinion on a proposed recommendation to the 2011 legislature on Nolan's Law. I'm not sure if he is familiar with it. It is just now coming out. However, it would affect all the judges within the court or our judicial system, along with district attorneys and law enforcement agencies. If you wouldn't mind, I would really like to read a letter from the legendary Jerry Spence, a well-known criminal defense attorney in our country.
Well, if you could tell us what Nolan's Law is, that'd be more helpful for our listeners, probably.
Okay, well, Nolan's Law is basically this. Right now, when a person is accused of a crime, they are arrested and then charged with the crime, and then it goes through the discovery process, at which time the law enforcement agency turns it over to the district attorney, and then the district attorney goes through the, and the defense, the counsel, goes through the procedures, you know, of evidence, discovery, and then it's turned over to them as well. What Nolan's Law would be, because it's based on some surrounding circumstances that has happened within the Washoe County DA's office, would be once that happens, once a person is arrested and charged with a crime, the law enforcement agency not only would turn it over to the district attorney, at this point they would now turn it over to the criminal defense attorney as well, thereby leveling the playing field from overzealous prosecutors who violate Brady. And then it would be left up to the judges to make that determination as to whether or not something is evidence is admissible for court or not. And basically what happened was this. 22 years ago, Nolan Klein, and this is why the law is being recommended, Nolan's Law, was arrested and charged with a crime. And he maintained his innocence. He actually truly was innocent of the crime. A former prosecutor by the name of Ron Rachel had withheld all the exculpatory evidence, the materiality evidence in the case. And this came about in 2009 when Judge Adams ordered District Attorney Dick Gamek to turn over the DNA test results along with the entire file in the case. And then on June 10th, 2009, we received the file, and in the file were the handwritten notes from the former prosecutor, Ron Rachel, stating he was not turning over any of the exculpatory evidence that showed another person was responsible for the crime that Nolan Klein was convicted of. All other evidence as well that showed not only was he being considered for this crime a suspect, as well as other crimes in which those victims had cleared him, all withheld from the defense. Right now, this was in June, and then in September, Mr. Klein passed away. And just prior to that, his attorneys were getting ready to file a motion for new trial based on newly discovered evidence that the district attorneys for the last office were aware of this and kept quiet.
Was he in prison when he died?
Yes, he was, and he was just about to be released.
What's your relation to the case?
He is my brother. And so basically what has now become of this, there's a writ of mandamus that I personally filed in Washoe County that's been assigned to Judge Flanagan. And he has ordered, I filed my writ. The DA's office has filed a response. I recently filed my reply. I've asked for a hearing. I've asked for a grand jury and indictments against all these people. But Nolan's Law basically is, it's to protect the rights of those. You know, any time there's a violation of a fundamental, someone's fundamental constitutional rights, it affects every one of us. And Nolan's Law would prevent this from those accused of not receiving a fair trial. So
what are your thoughts on it, Judge Perry? Based on what we've talked about here or what you may or may not know about this?
Well, first of all, I need to say that I don't have a great familiarity with the facts and circumstances that you're telling us about right now, Tanya, because I just don't know that case. Secondly, I have a little hesitation or reticence to get into a discussion of a case that's just been filed and could be active in the district in which I'm a judge. Even though it's not assigned to me, it's not inconceivable that some aspect of it could spill over into my department. Mm-hmm. And so to, you know, make specific comments, particularly without having all of the facts and circumstances, I think would not be a fair or an appropriate approach. I can say that in general, I believe that when evidence is discovered, scientific evidence, physical evidence, whatever kind of evidence is discovered, that it is beneficial to the system, that evidence be given to all of the people and that they have access to it, to all the people who are involved in it. Now that sounds That sounds nice, but that's not always very easy because we don't know in the beginning of a case who those people might be. We don't know who the defense lawyers are. We don't even know who the defendants are. And in some cases, there are instances where there's not enough evidence to be shared. And then there's some instances where I would imagine that there are circumstances where the sharing of evidence would diminish the value of that evidence. So I think it's, you know, we do have rules in place for discovery where when the state gets evidence that then the defense person comes into the case that they have access to it. And from when I started doing criminal work, which I haven't done for many years, but when I started doing it some almost 30 some years ago, the rules of discovery were really limited, and the defense got very, very little. And I will say I think that the process has improved over time. But just like any process, particularly in the criminal legal justice system, like any process, it never moves as fast as we would like it to. And we can always come to a particular case and say, look, you know, this. In this case, this is what should have happened, and not necessarily did it always happen. So without being specific about a pending case, I think in the absence of any further questions from you, I don't really think there's anything I can add to that.
Okay, thank you. Marilyn, what do you think about this proposed recommendation where it would be shared?
I'm of the same opinion in my cases, and I do civil family law only. I think the more information that goes back and forth, the better. And, you know, I try to give as much information on the front end, quite frankly, even before discoveries do, because I want the case to settle. And if there's weak spots, I mean, my area of law is very different, Tanya. Mine is best interest of the child, period. That's what I believe I have to strive for as well. So even if information's detrimental to my client, if it's in the best interest of the child that the court knows and the other side knows, I disclose it and my clients know that. So it's a little different, my area of law, but I absolutely believe that all sides deserve it. And I'm terribly sorry for your loss of your brother and this tragedy that's happened to your family. So
thank you.
I respect you a great deal for pursuing it all these years. He's a lucky brother to have you. And thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Tanya, can I add one thing as well?
Certainly.
The problem that I'm focusing on is that in criminal cases, a lot of the time, the police they'll accumulate evidence, and it might be days, weeks, or months before they even know who the defendant is or who the defense lawyer is. And in the meantime, they have to be doing certain things. They need to be doing certain things with that evidence in order to try to make those determinations. And so it's not always possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when it is possible, I'm 100% in agreement with you. When the evidence is there, the evidence is not going to be destroyed or somehow devalued by letting other people look at it, then as soon as they know that there's a suspect or that there's somebody that they can have review that, it should be reviewed.
Yes.
And perhaps even by an independent party up front, but I'd be concerned about the specifics of that because of the potential for costs and who would it be and
This law would be only once the person is arrested and charged with a crime.
I think once they're arrested and charged, I think the rules start to take over.
Correct. However, with our particular case, Rachel left his handwritten notes within the file stating he defied Judge Peter Breen's order to turn over discovery. He made notations on there that no showing of materiality, no showing of the exculpatory evidence, not to turn it over. And for 22 years through the appeals process, the district attorney's office, including Gamick, fought his convictions, knowing the whole time all this evidence that showed someone else was responsible for the crime was in that file. Thereby, they conspired to conceal a crime. And that's what this writ is based on. But Nolan's law is based on
preventative.
Once a person is accused of a crime and charged with a crime, then it is now, to stop this from happening again, the law enforcement agency would then turn over the evidence to both, because by then they will know who the defense is.
Sure.
All right.
And
thank
that's
you.
How it levels the playing field. That way everyone would receive, the accused would receive this, and also it's like the failure to turn over exculpatory evidence not only convicts innocent persons, but it is the reasons that rapists and murderers are released to walk among us. Prosecutors withhold evidence which requires the court to reverse conviction and has resulted in the release of persons who should remain behind bars. It protects the innocent and it protects the rights of the victims as well.
Yeah.
I believe it to be a win-win situation, and it would prevent people, and we're not just talking one or two people within the Washoe County District Attorney's Office. We are talking a dozen people.
Well, I hope you get justice, Tanya, and I will be following your case for sure, and thank you so much for calling. We have to go to a break now, so sit tight, those listeners, and I want to remind you guys, as always, to go to Junkie Clothing Exchange. And speaking of court, if you need a court outfit and you don't have a lot of money, that is a perfect place to go, because surprisingly, they have suits and all the good stuff, and Jessica will dress you accordingly. So tell her you're going to court. If you're my client, tell her. If you're my opposing client, definitely tell her, so she can mess up the case for me and make you look terrible. I'm just kidding. Okay, we'll be right back after the break. Thanks.
Not just news, your chance to talk about it. Fox 1270 in the morning, weekdays at 6 on Fox News Radio 1270.
Have you ever seen a square foot? Well, we've got 8,800 of them, and they're all fun. We're Junkie, 8,800 square feet of pure fun, because it's fun to save money, and it's fun to shop at Junkie. Got a theme party coming up? We can help you pull it all together. We've got the right look for your roaring 20s theme party. Been invited to a disco party? Need to look like Madonna or Cyndi Lauper? No problem. Our 80s gear is totally rad. Junkie has clothes for every kind of theme party. And Junkie can save you money on clothes for work, clothes for play, and clothes that are priced so low they just satisfy your urge to shop. You don't have to spend a lot to have a lot of fun. Some of our square feet are devoted to affordable retro furniture and vintage style home decor. You can decorate your home in a unique way at Junkie's Antique Mall. We also have tons of one-of-a-kind jewelry. So for affordable parties, clothes, accessories, retro furniture, and antiques, Junkie's the fun place to shop. Now we'll get serious and tell you where we're located. We're in the big brick building between Vassar and California on Virginia Street. Junkie is obviously the fun place to shop.
If you've never visited the Wild Horse Saloon, you need to come out and visit. It's Nevada's most unique saloon with great food, great libations, amazing entertainment 24 hours a day. What kind of entertainment, you ask? Well, the Wild Horse Saloon has brought back live burlesque shows with new shows starting every hour, 24 hours a day, with different entertainers every hour. No show is ever the same twice. So come to the Wild Horse. Throw your legs over the saddle. We have actual Western saddle bar stools. And order a cold beer. The Wild Horse Saloon is the place to go and let your hair down. Just have fun. We have fabulous food with everything from pizzas and wings to hamburgers and steaks. We're a huge lunch spot from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and we serve our full food menu until 10 at night and hors d'oeuvres the rest of the night. I'm Susan Austin, and I'm personally inviting you to come out and see us at the Wild Horse Saloon. Take I-80 East to exit 28. It's just 15 minutes from downtown Reno. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit. See you soon.
I'm attorney Marilyn York, and my firm exclusively focuses on men's rights in divorce, child custody, and family law matters. 90% of homeless and runaway children are from fatherless homes. 71% of all high school dropouts come from fatherless homes. These shocking statistics do go on and on. And yet, in the context of divorce and separation, 50% of mothers see no value in the father's continued contact with their children. 40% of mothers report that they have interfered with their father's visitation solely to punish their ex. We can help you protect your children from being a part of these statistics, even when their mothers won't. Our courts do care about you and your children. At a minimum, you need legal advice when you're going through something like this, and you may need representation. If you do, call me, Marilyn York, at 324-7979. That's 324-7979. Or visit our website at marilynyork.net.
There's a piece of Nevada's history just 15 minutes from downtown Reno. The legendary Mustang Ranch Museum, Nevada's first legal bordello. Learn about owner Joe Conforti, where he went sideways with the feds over taxes, and they ended up owning and operating the Mustang Ranch. Take a walk down memory lane with Joe and Sally. See where they lived while they worked. You can see the Rolling Stone magazine cover featuring Joe and his ladies, among other original magazine covers. The Mustang Ranch Museum runs tours from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. for groups large and small, Monday through Saturday. If you have a large group, please book in advance by calling 775-343-1424. Walk-ins are welcome, too. Tours cost $5. Plus, we have a wonderful gift shop with T-shirts, shot glasses, baseball caps, and the largest selection of Native American jewelry. Take I-80 East, exit 28, 15 minutes from downtown. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit, and that's where you'll find us. If you've never visited the Wild Horse Saloon, you need to come out and visit. It's Nevada's most unique saloon with great food, great libations, amazing entertainment 24 hours a day. What kind of entertainment, you ask? Well, the Wild Horse Saloon has brought back live burlesque shows with new shows starting every hour, 24 hours a day, with different entertainers every hour. No show is ever the same twice. So come to the Wild Horse. Throw your legs over the saddle. We have actual Western saddle bar stools and order a cold beer. The Wild Horse Saloon is the place to go and let your hair down. Just have fun. We have fabulous food with everything from pizzas and wings to hamburgers and steaks. We're a huge lunch spot from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and we serve our full food menu until 10 at night and hors d'oeuvres the rest of the night. I'm Susan Austin, and I'm personally inviting you to come out and see us at the Wild Horse Saloon. Take I-80 East to exit 28. It's just 15 minutes from downtown Reno. Follow the signs to the Wild Horse Canyon from the exit. See you soon.
Fox News Radio, 1270.
You're back on the Marilyn York Show with the Honorable Judge Robert Perry. So, Judge Perry, we're getting close to the end. Let's tie it up with a little controversy. Give us the lowdown on the Dick Gamet comment relating to the Bila ruling and what happened. Was it personal? What happened with that? Give me your version.
Well, there wasn't anything at all personal about it. We had a case where there was the jury had not yet decided the penalty phase, so the case was still open. The jury could still be susceptible to hearing comments that are being made by the lawyers. And I'd entered several orders during the case asking the lawyers not to make inflammatory comments or inappropriate comments about anything having to do with the case. And during the time after the guilty verdict but before the penalty verdict, Mr. Gamet was interviewed by members of the press, and he tried to deny this and say it was in a private conversation, but the reporter specifically said, oh, no, this was I was standing there with a pencil and a paper and writing down everything that was said, and he made the comment that the verdict in the case was better than sex. I know people have attributed my motive in admonishing him for that to a controversy that's existed between he and I for some time. More on his side. I try to set things in my life behind me and not carry things forward. It's like drinking poison and hoping that it's going to hurt somebody else. And I don't have any hard feelings about that. But I want to just assure everybody that had it been the other way around, had Mr. Bila been acquitted, and had one of his lawyers said, well, that verdict was better than sex, my reaction to that and my admonition to that lawyer would have been as strong or stronger than it was to Mr. Gamet. And I believe Mr. Gamet would have supported me in giving that admonition because, sometimes when we make statements in times that are exciting, and that certainly was an exciting time, we don't use our best judgment. And although that might have been a statement that would be appropriate in some people's view, in a bar and a private conversation, it's not my view that it furthered the image of the justice system, or that it delegated the proper amount of courtesy and honor to the solemnity of the process that we were in. And I felt as a judge it was my job to point that out. And as far as it being a personal vendetta, I would have done it no matter which lawyer did it, and I would in the future do it. I think that we are entitled to have lawyers that show respect for the system, and I think judges are required to mandate that respect be shown, particularly in public situations in sensitive circumstances. And that was the reason for it, and there was no other reason. And I don't want to make a big deal out of it unless it becomes necessary to do so.
I would just like to say I say stupid things as an attorney every so often, probably daily, and I think our judges should do it and need to do it more often, even with me. And so That being said, thank you so much for coming on the show, Judge Perry. It was wonderful talking to you. And if you guys want to see what shows are coming up in the future, get on the MarilynYorkShow.com and look up the schedule. Thanks again. Talk to you later.